This is the podcast for Wednesday, January 14th, 2015, Theories of Knowledge. And we were just reviewing some things we skipped over last week. And one is about the Gettier problem. The Gettier problem is a problem for what philosophical concept?
For knowledge.
Knowledge, right. And this might, you might get a question like, the Gettier problem is a problem for a truth, or the traditional theory of truth, or the correspondence theory of truth. Wrong, 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 wrong. B, the traditional philosophical definition of knowledge. Ding, 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 ding. C, some misleading answer that sounds really good but is totally off. D, some other, maybe a jokey answer, just so the test isn't too tough. And maybe the none of the above, they're in there just to confuse you. Or just to see if you know what you're talking about. So, so it's a problem for knowledge. So what's the problem? What's the Gettier, what's the Gettier problem, or how would you like sum it up? Yeah.
Well, it seems to be that arriving at true knowledge through an improper or wrong belief is also wrong. So it looks like the path toward knowledge needs to be correct, and also the knowledge itself needs to be correct in order to meet the criteria of true justified belief and knowledge.
Yeah, there's something that where the truth and the justification, they have to be connected in the right way. Because there's this weird thing that some beliefs logically imply other beliefs. So if I have a belief someone in this room owns a Porsche. Sorry, let me back up for a minute. If I have a belief that Lori owns a Porsche, then I also have a belief someone in this class owns a Porsche. Now suppose my belief that Lori owns a Porsche is false. But suppose I have really good reasons for believing it. But also suppose somebody else in the class does own a Porsche that I don't know about. Well, then my belief is true by virtue of falsely believing Lori has a Porsche. My belief is justified by in reference to my beliefs about that. But my belief is true with regard to this other person. So, if I said that right. So if I believe a particular person, say Lori, owns a Porsche, that belief could be false. But that implies the other belief, someone in my class owns a Porsche. If someone else in my class does in fact own a Porsche, my belief is true. But it's based on faulty reasons. But it could be those faulty reasons are just really good reasons that would convince any rational person. And I know Lori wouldn't do this, but perhaps some other person who suffers from low self-esteem and is overly materialistic and might put on a charade where they own a sailboat. Maybe they're trying to pick up a hot date or Porsche, sailboat, and maybe they like work at the Fern Ridge Reservoir, cleaning the docks or something. And there's some rich guy that leaves his sailboat sitting there, and they take pictures of themselves with it. And maybe they got a friend with a hot car, or maybe they work at a car wash, right? And they this guy leaves and goes to the electric station and leaves his car to be detailed. And after he's done, cleaning the dust off the dashboard and stuff, he takes it out for a spin and has his buddy take pictures of it. He's taking selfies with his cell phone. Here's my hot car, right? So if he's good enough and in presenting evidence, any reasonable person would be convinced. Maybe he even has a title and he photoshops his name onto the title. He takes it out of a box. People go to a lot of trouble to fool others. And so at a certain point, you'd have to say, yeah, that's pretty good evidence, right, that the person owns a Porsche. After a while, you'd think, well, it's just sort of overkill. So you have a true justified belief, but most people would say it's not knowledge. It's not, you don't know someone owns a Porsche in your... You don't know that someone in my class owns a Porsche because it's based on a hoax. And you don't really know. You don't know the thing that makes it true. You know something else that makes the belief true, which isn't true.
So it's faulty, belief. How do you simplify that? All that.
The truth and the justification have to match up in the right way, or be connected in the right way.
So they don't match and get your problem?
Yeah. Now, some people say, okay, well, just say knowledge can't be based on a false belief. Well, then you can come up with other examples where it's not based on a false belief, but it doesn't work for some other reason. And these examples, philosophers come up with these examples, and they just get more and more complicated. So this is a survey class, so we're not going to go into technical issues involving the Gettier problem. Most people think it can be patched up with, you know, a bunch of qualifiers. It's kind of like if you think about Newton's laws of motion. This, maybe this isn't the best analogy. It's a good analogy if you know Newton's laws of motion. Think about like Newtonian physics. Newtonian physics works for most things. If I'm trying to, you know, calculate something dealing with like medium-sized material objects on planet Earth, Newton is going to be pretty accurate. If I'm trying to get a space capsule to the moon, I got to know like all the things that would make my calculations just a little bit off, and some of those astronauts in deep space where they die of suffocation, right? Because when you deal with really big things or really small things, then the Einstein's, you know, findings help you be absolutely accurate. So most philosophers think the Gettier problem, it's good. It's a problem, and it's sort of this weird technical thing that can be hashed out. And isn't like a major, people aren't saying, well, the Gettier problem, so much for true justified belief. They see it as sort of a technical curiosity and something that you argue about in journals, but isn't really a major problem for the idea of knowledge is, roughly speaking, true justified belief. In the same way, you know, force equals mass times acceleration plus a bunch of junk that you have to figure in when you figure in relativity. But for most purposes, F equals ma is just fine. So anyway, so all you need to know about the Gettier problem for this class is it's a problem for the traditional theory of knowledge, and the problem is that sometimes you have a belief which is both true and justified, but intuitively doesn't seem to count as knowledge. And that's a problem because if knowledge is true, justified belief, then every time you find a belief which is true and justified, you should know it. But here, there's some funny cases where it doesn't. So that's all about the Gettier problem. This is so if you go on to a upper division class at the U, you don't say, well, Bardell told me that knowledge was true, justified belief. Oh, community college instructors, they don't know about the Gettier problem, I guess. So now you know about the Gettier problem. The weird thing about this isn't come out till like, it's like in the 60s. Nobody sort of, this problem didn't come up until that. You think about like 2,000 years of, 2,500 years maybe of philosophy and 1960s when somebody had a bunch of time in their hands, were like, I wonder what would happen if you, oh, that's interesting, you know, publishes and there's this big, you know, dueling philosophers in the journals about knowledge is true justified belief and how there's maybe a little problem with it. Okay, moving along to Descartes. So last time we talked about Plato and Descartes. We talked about the cave allegory, the problem of skepticism. And the gist of like the cave and the matrix and Descartes' dream argument and the arch deceiver argument, they're all asking this question.
Sort of skepticism.
They all suppose skeptical problems. Oops. So, okay, here's a question. What is skepticism?
The theory that there's knowledge is really hard to attain or it's unattainable?
Yeah, knowledge is either impossible or difficult to obtain. So Descartes has the dream argument and the arch deceiver argument. And How do I know I'm not dreaming? And this is really, you think about this as questions of sense perception. And sometimes these are referred to as, this is a good technical term, we'll be dealing with that through the rest of the term, a posteriori beliefs. An a posteriori belief is Latin, it's two words, a posteriori. An a posteriori belief is a belief that comes through sense experience. And for example, I have a hand in front of my face, right? Or the fire is warm, right? So you have particular beliefs. I'm holding a piece of paper in my hand and writing on it. So those are all a posteriori beliefs. They're beliefs based on this, what the senses are telling you. And Descartes says, well, I think all those beliefs are true, and then boom, I wake up, I'm not sitting in my chair, I'm flat on my back, there's no fire, there's no paper. It's all a dream. And so, how do I know my senses aren't fooling me right now? So, and the arch deceiver argument, how do I know there isn't a being just like God, only evil, intent on deceiving me, or, you know, let's say tricking me, i.e. making me believe false things? And then if I can't, then how can I be convinced that any of my beliefs are true? Because the arch deceiver is a lot smarter than I am, right? He's this being that's supposed to be, again, just like God, he's omnipotent, he can do anything, but he's also evil, and so he tries to fool me. Well, there's no way I could outsmart him, and so is there anything I could ever know? And this is the what Descartes here doing here is this, his method of doubt, or methodological doubt. And this is his these are little thought experiments. And notice that when he's going through his meditations, he kind of goes back and forth. He says, well, wait a minute, that's crazy. There's like people in mental institutions that say, be careful, I'm made of glass, if you touch me, I might break, right? People that have these delusions. Of course, people have hallucinations. Just because somebody believes something doesn't make it true. But then I think about, how do I know I'm not having an hallucination? And he kind of like, you know, waffles back and forth, thinking about, you know, how do I know? Well, and goes back and forth between saying things like, well, of course, when I see my hand in front of my face, I know my hand's in front of my face. And then he thinks, well, but when I was dreaming the other day, I thought my hand was in front of my face, and it wasn't. So this is him kind of working through his doubts and trying to figure things out, and you're writing it in the form of a journal. It's meditations, right? And his idea is to doubt everything and see what's left. Is there any, or does he have any beliefs which are beyond doubt or beyond question? So are there any beliefs? I have, which are beyond doubt. Indubitable. Is that how you spell indubitable? Undoubtable. So So everybody remember, what does he come up with? What can't be doubted? Or is there anything?
Are there any beliefs obtainable?
I think he thinks that if there's something that you can't possibly doubt, that's going to be your foundation for knowledge. So the idea is to put every belief up to scrutiny. Oh, does this? How do I know this is true? How do I know this is true? Okay. And so, is there a belief you come to and you say, that's just got to be true. There's no way it could possibly be false. And whatever that belief is, that's what you're going to start building your house of knowledge on. And he thinks about knowledge as being like a structure. You have a foundation, and then you have to build on top of it. Otherwise, it's going to crumble like a house of cards. That's why he wants to start all over again. He wants to get rid of these half-baked notions that he has from childhood and, you know, then and later that don't give a that might be faulty, because it's like having a rotten foundation. If that collapses, then the whole thing's going to fall over. Let me ask this question first. Is Descartes a skeptic?
Yes.
Okay. I hear some yeses. Anybody say no? This is hard to come by.
Difficult to attain.
I think he's a partial skeptic.
There's a skeptic is someone who draws skeptical conclusions, so, and has doubts about the limits and scopes of human knowledge. And maybe I should put that up to you. Difficult to obtain. And the scope of human knowledge is limited. Very limited. Let's say, well, there's only so much we paltry human beings can know, and you know, you think you have it figured out, and then it turns out you're wrong. And how could humans, with their puny little brains, that can't even get along, can't agree on anything, how could we ever know anything for sure? Like that's a skeptic. How do I know there's a hand in front of my face? So, Descartes starts out, he's doubting things, but his doubt is a method. It's a way to try to get at the truth. Now, where does Descartes get at the end of his meditation, for those of you who've gotten that far?
What's his overall conclusion?
Yeah.
That he exists, God exists.
Yep.
The material world exists, mm-hmm. So we perceive it.
So does that sound like a skeptic? Like if I say, I'm absolutely sure there's a God who creates the world and everything in it, and he's good, and he wouldn't deceive us, and so all of our beliefs, well, we kind of work at them, we can come up with true beliefs about the world, and put our faith in science, and put our faith in God, and we have free will, and basically, you know, all the stuff that we thought that we knew before, those are pretty much, you're able to give a philosophical justification for all those things. I mean, it doesn't sound very skeptical to me. So, but then Descartes wondering like whether he exists. So he asks how do I know 2 and 3 is 5? So he starts out with a skeptical method. But the method is to try to clear out all the junk and then get to the foundation of knowledge. So you think about this as being kind of like panning for gold or something, right? He's got, you go about panning for gold, you put, get all the junk in your pan, you kind of slide it back and forth, and the gold, which is heavier, settles to the bottom, and all the other junk sort of floats to the top and goes off. Or you can think about, you know, cooking, and the cream rises to the top, or whatever metaphor you like. It's the idea of separating out the wheat from the chaff, right? To take a rural metaphor. So Descartes thinks that you try to doubt everything and see what's left. So in Descartes' meditations, what's left with him? He has with his method of doubt, and he doubts everything. And he says there's one thing you can't doubt.
That he exists.
Yeah. So
Cogito ergo sum.
I think, therefore I am. Descartes in a bar. Bartender comes up to him and says, hey, Descartes, have another round. And Descartes says, I think not, and disappears. One of the few lousy philosophy jokes I have. So that's what this is from. It's like, I think, therefore I am. So what does he mean by this?
That we exist.
That we exist, okay. And how do I know I exist?
Because you can ponder the concept of existence.
So he knows he exists because he's pondering the concept of
existence. How he says that he knows he exists is he brings up the idea of the arch-deceiver. How does he know there's not a God that's tricking you at every corner? And he says, well, the fact that you can even doubt anything, the existence of the arch-deceiver or even yourself, is kind of the basis of his what he believes is justification for his own existence.
Mm-hmm. Another way you could put this is, I doubt, therefore I am. Doubt implies a doubter. Logically. Like, if there's doubting going on, there has to be someone who is doubting. Thinking implies a thinking subject or a mind, a consciousness. So he says, if you're doubting, there has to be a doubter. So the arch deceiver, if the arch deceiver is deceiving someone, he's deceiving me. Well, what is the me? In order for there to be a deception going on, there has to be a deceiver and a deceived. Well, the deceived has to exist, otherwise there could be deception. There can't be deception without someone who is being deceived. And that's me, the example. So he says, try as hard as you want, the arch deceiver can never deceive me into thinking I'm nothing when I'm something. Because as long as he's deceiving me, I'm being deceived. And then there's an I that is being deceived. That's why I exist. Is there a question?
If he had a different culture that he lived in, it seems like his beliefs are predicated on a strong Christian foundation, because he's coming up with a dualism. If he was in a different culture, would he have a different belief? Let's say he was Buddhist without a dualism.
Well, a lot of Buddhists are dualists, though.
Well,
dualistic,
sure. I'm just trying to wonder.
Right,
if he's coming up with the arch deceiver and assuming that it's not evil based on the fact that it's a constant or what's he say, a clear, distinct belief.
Yeah,
seems kind of self-justification.
Well, this is just like a hypothetical example, though. He's using this. The arch deceiver doesn't necessarily have the trappings of Christianity. For example, in Christianity, the Satan or the devil is not omnipotent, and it's actually not sort of biblical Christianity isn't dualistic in the sense that it's not like there's like the forces of good and the forces of evil, like in Star Wars, where you have the light side and the dark side. It's there's God, who's kind of the embodiment of goodness and existence and the origin of all things, and then there's Satan, this kind of pissant angel that gets too big for his britches and gets kicked out of heaven and causes trouble for God, and God's going to get rid of him eventually, but in the meantime he serves a certain purpose. So that's sort of the framework Descartes is coming from. But this doesn't necessarily fit the Christian framework, because he's saying, well, imagine not just like life is illusory, but that there's an intelligent being who's super smart and trying to fool me. If that's the case, then how would I ever know it? So it's he's trying to come up with like the best case scenario for skepticism. So he kind of, this is what they call like in, you're writing a screenplay, they talk about raising the stakes, right? So, you know, why should I care about this character? Oh, why is it important? And so you start out with like, if he doesn't attain this goal, he's going to lose his job. Big deal, why do I care? But you know, you might say, well, he's going to lose his job and his girlfriend. Okay, I suppose that makes me feel kind of sorry for him. Oh, but then if you say, if he gets kicked out of school, he'll never make this great scientific discovery that will save the world from a plague or something. And then, oh, tentpole movie, high concept or whatever. So this Descartes kind of raising the stakes here, where it's not just he's making it really, really hard to obtain knowledge. So he's saying it's not just that life might be a dream and it'd be hard to figure out that it was a dream. It's that there's this guy, he's super, super smart, and his only goal in life is to make you believe all this false stuff because he's evil and he loves fooling people. And so imagine there's a being like that out there. Well, how do you know there isn't, right? And you think, well, that's ridiculous. That's what the Arch-Deceiver wants you to think, right? So it's this, he's... And it's not necessarily, you know, even though Descartes is a Catholic and he's, you know, writing at the you know, cusp of the modern era, he's sort of got one foot in the Middle Ages. I think it's a mistake to just see him as sort of, you know, prisoner of his own culture and kind of spouting off Christian stuff. Because he's in this book, he's writing this book because he's afraid of the church. He's afraid that if he publishes his book on astronomy, he's going to end up on the rack. Are burned at the stake. And even though in his introduction he makes a sort of slavish deference to the church authorities, I mean, he's kind of toadying under so he can doesn't, you know, end up in prison. Right? So I to see Descartes as sort of this friend of the church, I think he's in a lot of ways he's being subversive and that he's trying to give philosophy and reason equal footing with faith and the church. But I don't see there are any particularly Christian ideas here. You know, Plato and some other later philosophers have sort of idea of personal deities. I don't know, Plato's probably a good example, but...
They all have some form of, you know, like if it's not the Arch-Deceiver, it's Plato and his religious stuff. It seems like there's a common theme here.
I think even... Like, even if Descartes is an atheist. So, and actually, it's a good point. So, I think you do raise, like, the question of, like, could you have, like, a materialist version of this? You had your hand up.
Yeah, well, I mean, it kind of sounds like this Arch-Deceiver. It sounds like he might be hinting at, like, the Norse god of mischief, Loki.
Yeah, you could, sure, you could do Loki, yeah. The troublemaker, right?
Yeah.
So, and you can, there's even, and this is actually a good point to bring in, the brain of the bat argument. This is a modern version. Going back to the Matrix, the brain in a bat. So the idea is that imagine... imagine this is you. Here's your brain, and it's in like this vat of nutritive liquid, and it's got a bunch of electrodes plugged in. It's got a bunch of big computer bank. I know computers don't work anymore. You know, and here's where you put the punch cards in, right? And then you have, you know, some race of alien beings that are experimenting on you. All right, so there's you, and now the evil our alien overlords say, okay, now it's time for the Philosophy 202 simulation. Mario's going to draw a family on the board. And then he's like, you know, there's like programmed simulation. So the question is, you know, how do you know that it's not like that? And so here you don't have to assume that there are, you know, disembodied consciousnesses are possible. You can assume materialism. You can you don't have to think about spirits or the concept of omnipotence and whether that's a coherent concept or anything religious at all. So you replace the archdeceiver with our alien overlords, and it's the same deal. Yeah.
It reminds me, too, of that Jim Carrey movie, The Truman Show.
Oh, uh-huh. Yes. Yeah, yep.
Yeah, where his entire life was alive from the time he was a baby.
Yeah, he, you know.
So paranoid.
There you go. And you figure out, like, why, you know. Go ahead.
Yeah. In order to know that you're... to know the deceiver, you would have to first know that you were being deceived.
Mm-hmm.
And that would imply some sense of truth, that you have some inner sense of truth.
Yeah, you would, if you knew you were being deceived, that would sort of be the first step. But then, if the archdeceiver is smart enough, or if our alien overlords are clever enough, you would never know. I mean, if you started out, like maybe they grew your brain in a vat, like from scratch, based on some DNA that sort of cloned the brain, just grew the blood brain. Or maybe they took out your brain out when you were a baby, after you're born, and took it out of your skull and put it in this vat with a bunch of wires to insert and send you experiences. Can you think about the way you have experiences? So like your average, you know, Joe or Jane, here you are, with a lantern chin, I guess. And here's your brain in here. And then like you look at something like a tree, you know. You're an Oregonian, you love trees. Sometimes you hug them, right? And light waves bounce off the sun. Oh, wait, it's Oregon. Light waves sort of try to pierce through the cloud. Come down. It's raining when you're depressed. And it's a good thing your brain's in your skull as you get all soggy and wet. And but you have, they go into your eye and you know, put a little image on your retina, and then go into your brain via the optic nerve, and then you have this experience of the tree in your mind. But you know, what's this optic nerve here thing going on here? This is just like little, you know, ones and zeros. It's digital data. It's electrical impulses going to your optic nerve and your in your brain, synapses, they're all like little switches, and there's electrons jumping across from one nerve cell to the other, giving this experience. Well, why could somebody just sort of like interpret these electrical impulses and record them, and then you'll create it from scratch, figure out, okay, how do I create a sensation of the tree, and just, you know, it's just a complex load of data. It's like you think about, like, you have a JPEG of a tree on your computer, right? You double click it, there is a picture of the tree. Well, it's just a bunch of digital data. So why can't the tree move? Why can't the tree, you know, why can't it be just like a video game? It's all, again, programmed stuff. So imagine, like, our alien overlords who are centuries advanced. Well, they could program a total virtual reality thing. How would we ever know?
I don't think we ever would, though.
No. There you go. So then Descartes wonders that. And what's Descartes' answer here, though?
Since the only thing he can know is that he can think.
Yeah. So he says, at least you know that. You can, you know that if you're being deceived by our alien overlords, that you exist. You don't know what you look like. Maybe your idea about like brains is all wrong. That's part of like the scenario. Maybe you look like this, right? And you're in the simulation makes you think that you're this human being with two arms, two legs, and a head. And maybe there are no such things as human beings. But at least you know that you have a mind, you can think. It could be, you know, you live in a dark and stormy world, like the Matrix or something like that, that it's, you know, intelligent machines going around, post-apocalyptic, and yada yada, right? So there's another case where the world could be totally different than you think it is. But there's one thing you can be sure of to start out with, that you exist. So Descartes says, okay, here's something I know. Regardless of whether it's Cloud Cuckoo Land with their alien overlords, the Archdeceiver, all my beliefs about the external world and the way things are, you know, the
solar system. I mean, you think about all the things you take for granted. All that could all just be a bunch of hooey, and it would be totally different than you think it is. But the one thing you do know is that you exist. Yeah.
I actually remember going around a while ago that there were some scientists performing tests to see if our world and our universe was actually a giant computer simulation, which I thought was kind of interesting. I haven't heard like if the tests came back positive.
I don't know how to test that.
I'm not really sure.
It sounds like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy,
right?
Or something.
But I just thought it was kind of interesting.
The sort of idea in Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's all a computer simulation. So there's a lot of fiction that asks this question, like, well, what if it's all a dream? What if it's all an illusion? What if ordinary life is just totally different than what the world is totally different than we conceive of it and perceive it? So Descartes says, all I know right now is I exist. Okay, well,
it's got to be real.
It's something, right? The I exist. It's like you start out at square one. That's going to be his foundation for knowledge. This is
that's what we're going to build on. So, if you have a question, like, what's Descartes' foundation for knowledge? A, B, C, D. And you see something like, cogito ergo sum, or I think, therefore I am, or I exist. That's the one you're looking for. That's the starting point for knowledge. Okay, I prove I exist. Now what? Now what's Descartes' next idea?
We had free will, and then it becomes, I am what I am because I chose to be what I am.
That third step, I think, isn't Descartes.
No, that was mine.
Okay, yeah. So I was thinking with Descartes right now. I don't know, can you really choose to be who you are? I mean, you might choose your character, but I don't know if you can choose. Like, I can't choose to not be a human being. And, let you know, it's up for in our transhumanist future, where I'll have, like, you know, cybernetics and can, like, muck around with my genes, turn myself, translucent purple or whatever.
Halfway in the day.
Just for fun. People won't have to dye their hair. They'll just, like, you know, take a little injection, and their hair will turn whatever color they want. It'll be cool. I'll have eyes inside your head that can move in different directions. What do you think? Anyway, but I can't, like, right now, choose to not be human. Even momentarily, idea is just changing your beliefs. There's a lot of things that are hard to do on turning on a dime, as it were. But I don't want to get distracted here. So I exist. So what's the next step? Is it what comes before, like, the talk about free will? It starts with almost something easy. So I proved I exist. Okay, I exist as a thinking thing, right? As it proved, he has a body. So I exist, I'm qualified here as a thinking thing. So what am I? A thing which thinks. A thing which doubts. A thing which wonders. And so he goes on to all the different forms of thinking. And then step two, prove God exists. That wasn't where I would go. And this is maybe to add some credence to your idea that Descartes sort of lives in this hyper-religious culture and he thinks this is the next logical step. But this is, there's a method to his madness. Because he thinks if he can prove God exists, he can prove all these other things that will fall neatly into place. So it's going to be worth it. So he gets thinking the following way. He thinks, well, sometimes there's some beliefs which are under my control and there's some that aren't. And so, like, I can imagine things and then I, like, experience things that I don't imagine that come to me sort of, I'm a passive recipient. And I call those my perceptions of the external world. And he thinks, well, if I were in control of everything, my life would be a lot different than it is now. So these experiences come to me whether I want them or not. are they coming from the outside? And this gets him to think about, am I the only consciousness? Or is there another consciousness out there? And so he thinks that it seems there's got to be something out there in addition to me, otherwise I would have experiences I don't want.
Why does there got to be? Someone's stuff.
Because I would, I would know if I was like, if I have a toothache, would I give myself a toothache? Well, what if I don't want the toothache? And I say, toothache, go away, and the toothache continues. Seems like something's got to be the cause of that. So this gets him thinking about, is it just me that's controlling the dream, or is there something besides me in the world? And so this is how he gets around like solipsism, or the idea only I exist. He thinks there's got to be something else. So he tries to prove God, not one, but two, but three ways. So let's look at these proofs. And basically, the idea, if he can prove God exists, and then his next idea is God is good. And if God is good, God is no deceiver. And then if that's true, then knowledge.
He was on the right track. He was trying to prove, you know, here I am, I'm a thinking thing, and then he goes to, you know, God and all that unprovable, you know.
Well, like what was mentioned earlier about how he kind of has to grovel at these people's feet so he doesn't get put on the rack, you can kind of partially attribute that to maybe why that he wants to use God's existence as a foundation to build off of his other ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And be more accepted?
I'd say it's for more acceptance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You're probably right.
Well,
you have to accept your first tenet, then logically they'll accept most of what follows. But if they're already disagreeing with you, if he was to try to say something other than God exists, that would probably be at the time what the church would go back to, is that argument over and over again.
Okay, I think about this. Like, I'm trying to toady for the church, and I'm writing a book of philosophy. And I think I'll say, first of all, I'll say I'm going to doubt everything. Including, like, you know, he doesn't say, like, the Bible is the Word of God, or, the church is the ultimate authority. He says, I know what I'll do. I'll turn out my book saying, what if God doesn't exist but the devil does? That's going to make people happy. So, I mean, even though it's very tempting to see him as putting all this religious stuff in there just because because he's a religious, because he's worried about the church, I think that's, like, the opposite thing. So, on the one hand, Descartes is motivated to try to make sure that science and religion go together. And he's also trying to do something philosophical and secular, which is based on reason. On the other hand, he does have these religious presuppositions that affect his work. So it seems that there's kind of a middle course where you'd say, yes, he has these religious influences, but he's also trying to do something rational and philosophical. And yes, he's worried about the church, but to see this as sort of the main driving force behind his work, I think is also a mistake and kind of cynical. Not that I'm being critical of that interpretation, the motivations for it being cynical, but that approach is kind of cynical. It sees this sort of as, I don't know, but Descartes is not really sincere in what he's right.
Well, I don't think I would necessarily, I wasn't trying to say that was the whole reason for it, but that was a contributing factor to why that would kind of be the direction he would go.
Yeah,
he basically has to do something to deal with this arch-deceiver aspect of it, though, something to keep that in brain, or else it makes knowledge impossible.
Yeah, I think his argument is so good. A lot of people think that Descartes should have stopped the meditation too and said skepticism is the way to go. But he's made such a good argument in meditation too. Maybe only God is the only solution that's going to deal with it. In Descartes, maybe from Descartes' point of view. So anyway, he thinks that proving God's existence is the next step. And so he starts out, let's see, what are the arguments we have for God's existence? Anybody want to, like, give a capital summary of one of them?
Well,
kind of
something can't come from nothing.
Yeah, something can't come from nothing. So where, so where does my idea of God come from? So his arguments
for God. Only God could explain. Only my idea of God.
Oops. So why does he think this? He thinks I have an idea of God, therefore there must be a real God. Well, you know, I have an idea of a unicorn. Does that mean there has to be a real unicorn?
I think so.
I guess not.
But is God different than other ideas? I think Descartes wants to say that God, the idea of God is different than any other idea you would ever have. It's a special kind of idea. It's a special idea because it has qualities that other ideas don't have. So God is an infinite and perfect being. Well, what about me? Well, Descartes says I know this from introspection. You know, I am a finite, you know, limited, and imperfect being. So how could I come up with the idea of God on my own? How could my imagination have produced the idea just not of a great being, not just of a great and powerful being, but of an infinitely powerful and infinitely perfect being, or completely perfect being? And Descartes says, how can the imperfect create the perfect? How can the limited create the unlimited? How can the finite produce the infinite?
These are kind of far out there concepts. Where do they even come from in the first place?
Well, Descartes would say they come from God, because there is an actual God who implanted the idea of himself in each of our consciousnesses. That's where you get the idea of Descartes' concept of innate ideas. So what do you think about this as an argument? How could the infinite... I'm a paltry human being. My imagination only goes so far. Sure, I might think of like a super powerful being, but where did I get the idea of infinity? That's the idea of infinity is an infinite idea. It has the quality of being infinite. I have the quality of being finite. How can the finite produce the infinite? How can an imperfect being such as me come up with the idea of a perfect being? And Descartes says, you can't do it. Therefore, the only explanation for my idea of an infinite and perfect being is that there is an actually infinite and actually perfect being out there in the universe that created me and gave me that idea in my mind.
Do we have a definition of the word perfect by any chance?
Perfect. No. Without flaw or defect. Complete, lacking no perfect qualities, or lacking no qualities which would make the being better than other already was. So perfection seems to imply there's no defect or flaw or shortcoming, and there's also it's complete. The completeness is also part of perfection. It can't be missing anything. So, everybody convinced there's a God? You all go to church on Sunday? I suppose religion is a separate question. Counter arguments to this.
Well, you could ask the same questions in reverse.
Okay, it's like, how would you do that?
Why would an infinite being create a finite? Or why would an imperfect being have imperfection?
I suppose the first question you might say, like, it would be possible for a perfect being to create an imperfect being. That, I mean, that doesn't seem like there's a problem there. If you have... It seems like if one thing has a quality, it can't... If something lacks a quality, it can't impart it to a thing a quality doesn't have. If... what would be an example? If I don't have $100, I can't give you $100. Now, the thing is, if I have $100, would I have to give you $100? Well, no. I could not give you any money at all. I could give you $50. I could give you a dollar. Right? So, in the same thing with, like, if God's an infinite and perfect being, maybe God could create another perfect being. Or he could create imperfect beings. Seems like he could do either one. But the problem is, when you think about it, an imperfect being created a perfect being. That's when things get weird. Because you think, well, if you're imperfect yourself, how could you create a perfect being? And he thinks the idea of God is a perfect idea. And so how could a flawed human being come up with a perfect idea? That's sort of the idea. Or how could a limited being come up with the idea of an unlimited being? Unless there actually were an unlimited being, that's the source of that idea. Which is what Descartes suggests. So, any thoughts on that?
I think the whole concept of God is just the answers to all the unknown questions that people have. You know?
So, oh! Yeah. All right. Yeah. Okay. God. So, if you think about, and I suppose anthropologically, that might be a reason why people believe in God, but it doesn't address like the epistemological or the metaphysical question.
I just don't see those sentences as being. They just don't seem to be solid, factual basis of knowledge. They seem to be more like they were, like, deduction or... they don't seem to be justified. Like, I think, therefore, I am. I mean, I understand it. Like, I get that he's correct, I think, but I don't think, like, he's completely right. Like, I think it fits some instances, but I'm not, like, Gettier, but I probably could come up with... the right sentence to explain what I'm trying to say. It just doesn't seem like that's he says I'm going to get rid of everything that I assume,
right.
You know, and then to me there just seems to be assumptions in it.
I see what you mean. You think that he's sort of maybe he wants to prove God's existence, even though he says he started over, he's thinking, well, there are all these things that I already kind of sort of think are true, and all I got to do is prove them.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, people that say, I know the corporations are evil, I know they're running my life, and I know business is evil and corporations are evil, and all I got to do is prove it. And now I'm going to, like, I'll, like, rent 5 left-wing documentaries telling me about how evil Walmart are and how the Koch brothers are evil and how blah, 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 right. And they look for, like, confirming evidence to try to prove all the things they already know from things that they've heard. And Descartes you might see him as kind of doing the same thing. Or you have religious people that say, well, I know that my religion is true, therefore I'll read all these books, you know, that say one way or another, here are all the reasons why my religion is true and everybody else is wrong. and they don't even, like, read, like, the books of the other people that are about their religion except for. They just read people that say, my religion's right and everybody else is wrong. So maybe that's going, maybe Descartes is, has some blinders on or is biased in some way. But I don't know if that necessarily addresses his, like, the cogency of his arguments. So there's a difference between his motivation and maybe the fact that he has bias and, like, point out, like, what's the flaw in the argument? Because even if a person is biased to make an argument, it might turn out that they're right or their argument is a good one. Well, how about this? What is the concept of infinity? Infinite. What does infinite mean?
It goes on
forever.
All right. Is there another way of thinking about infinite?
All-knowing?
Yeah. No limits. So, I have a concept of a limit, or unlimited. I have a concept of a limit, right? So, what I'm doing here when I have a concept of infinity, I'm just thinking about limits and then kind of imagining them away one after the other. And I think, well, I'm limited in certain ways, and that I have a physical body. There's certain things I can't do. There's certain things I can't know. I have moral flaws. I had a beginning in time. So all these limits on my existence. So, but I can imagine, I think about, well, what if I could do anything? What if I knew everything? What if I didn't have a body? What if I existed as a disembodied mind? What if I didn't have a beginning in time? What if I just always existed? So you kind of imagine away all the limitations on a human being, and eventually come up with the concept of God. You're not treating infinity as a positive concept. It's just the negation of a concept. It's a negation of the concept of limitation. You have a concept of limitation, you have a concept of negation, and you just kind of put those together. So, I have a concept of limited, I negate that, I have a concept of unlimited. It doesn't mean I have a positive concept of infinity or that I can grasp infinity in some sort of infinite way. Or that do you have to be infinitely smart to grasp the concept, or infinitely intelligent to grasp the concept of infinity? No, you just have to have the concept of limitation, and then just sort of imagine no limits or no limitations. So it seems like just you could just imagine the concept of infinity, and you don't need an actual God to do that. So that might be one way around. So this is sort of an abstraction. So the concept of God could come from abstraction. So that maybe is one counter argument. The other one is, this is kind of the bottom here. The concept of God evolved as anthropologists. Apologists and historians suggest. So you can see, suggest. So anybody do like history of religion or study like indigenous traditions or is God, what we talked that you mentioned, like different cultures have different beliefs. So, what are like the earliest beliefs of God like? What's that?
Weren't there many gods?
Yeah, lots of different gods, right? And what are those gods like?
Gods of nature.
Yep, sure. Gods represented the force of nature, the unknown, explanation for the unknown.
Yeah, with human qualities.
Mm-hmm.
We were on the same page.
Yeah. You have finite spirits of nature. You have, animal totems. People worship their ancestors, right? And these spiritual beings are good, bad, indifferent, sometimes mischievous, sometimes helpful, sometimes very unhelpful, right? And you get this move from the sort of earliest animism. And then you get people move into big city-states, and you get polytheism, where you have a kind of a hierarchy of the gods. You still have lots of different gods, but you have a kind of a hierarchy with major, like usually a king of the gods at the top, and then some sort of major gods and minor deities, and all the way down to this, to these nature spirits and particular spirits and ancestors sometimes too.
So that would be like Greek mythology?
Yeah, exactly. Like Greek, the Greek or Norse mythology, or your pre-Islamic paganism. Greek or Norse myths, people are mostly familiar with, you know, the Odin and Thor and Loki and so on. And then you get finally you get actually you get monolatry. It's kind of an intermediary step where you have, there's one god who's sort of the true god or the greatest god, and then there's like a bunch of posers and false gods, or sometimes it's just like minor spirits and deities or sometimes worship. But there's this idea of this sort of main high god, and then there's the other lesser spiritual beings. And then finally you get this monotheism, where there's only one god. But monotheism takes a really long time to develop. And it seems that as human society evolves, God gets grander and more abstract and more transcendent and less human. And as human beings get more and more sophisticated, and you go from, like, say, Zeus, even in Greek culture, Zeus starts out as a sort of tyrant who sees power, an opportunist who plays political games, treats humanity and human beings sort of a chessboard. His hobby is going down and having sex with mortal women. He gives birth to these bastard children that are, you know, heroes and like Hercules, right? So he's seen as like a human king. Later on, he becomes like the personification of justice and goodness, and these sort of human qualities kind of drop out. Yeah.
At the same time, those monotheism kind of takes over, and this is, I'm considering about when the Christian Greek scriptures come around in the Bible. You also notice that the enemy, the devil, takes over also in a lot more power, a lot more authority, and a lot more control over certain aspects of creation. The god of the system of things, he's called, whatever, in the Bible.
Right.
And so as Descartes posits this arch deceiver, it's implicit that he's going to have God come in there at some point to control this individual, or else, you know, it ain't going to work. There can be no true knowledge, you know, as long as you have that arch deceiver there without God,
yeah.
You can control.
Yeah. I got that's right. That part of that sort of motivation that Descartes has is to try to solve the problem. You need something really robust that's going to say, hey, you can really put your trust in human knowledge. And his idea is that, you know, this, he has a couple other arguments. We'll talk about ontological argument next. Ontological argument. And these are in the text. And these are the two we're sort of focusing on, these two. Once he's proved God exists, and then he says, well, God has to be good. And he says, if you think about evil, it's sort of a flaw. Someone, evil is a lack, is you're lacking moral perfection. So he says, if you think about, like, people who are bullies, usually they're, you know, have a screwed up childhood and they're being, you know, abused at home, they got low self esteem, have a problem in school, taking their aggression out on others. So it's seen as that if a person is, if a being is evil, evil is a lack of something, and the goodness is a positive quality. And so if God is a perfect being, he couldn't be evil because evil is a flaw. And so therefore he couldn't be a deceiver. And if God is no deceiver, then what kind of world would he have to create? Well, a world where knowledge is possible, where if human beings do their best, they should be able to get knowledge of the world. If the world is such that if you try your best, you end up with false beliefs, that makes God into a trickster or sort of this malevolent deceiver, and we prove that God could be like that. That if there is a God, and he's a perfect being, and that's what the definition of God is, then he has to be perfectly good also. If he's perfectly good, he had to create a world where knowledge is possible. So
have a couple of things to do next week. One is, make sure to look on the section of text on rationalism. And there's a couple of examples there that Descartes talks about the piece of wax. Oops. And the man seeing from the window. And we'll talk about it briefly on some Wednesday.
And then on Wednesday, we're going to be moving on to empiricism and John Locke and starting talking about innate ideas and Locke's classification of ideas and see the empiricist counterpoint to rationalism. So see you on Monday. Right? No, on Wednesday. Next Wednesday, the 21st.